Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News the authors and one of the photographers in a very recently published book, Freo Groove, Musicians of Fremantle. And welcome to Bill Lurie and Claire Moody and Jeff Atkinson. G'day, Bill.
G'day, Michael.
And Claire.
Hi, Michael.
And Jeff.
Good morning.
Now, you're the first mentioned in the credits here, Bill. Tell us where this book, Freo Groove, came from. And if Claire's the right person to answer that, just point at her.
Well, Claire is, in some ways, the right person to answer that, because having voiced the original idea after a sitting around in the Hilton Bowling Club watching a great band, Claire said, yeah, let's do it, and was really the reason that we went from an idea to an actuality.
Now, what made you make that comment, Claire?
Well, it was something that Bill really passionately wanted to do, and I thought it would be fun, actually. So we, without really too much more thought, we just went out and interviewed our first musician, which was Peter Woodward, Woody of the 10 Cent Shooters. And he just did a fantastic interview and loved the idea. And we had a great night. And so we kind of thought, right, who will we do next? It was all a bit random in the beginning. And I think we did Jean Guy next, who is a fantastic harmonica player. You've probably seen him playing in many bands around Fremantle. I think Jean Guy was next. And so we went on, and really, as I say, it was really quite random in the beginning. And it wasn't until probably a few months later that we started to think, okay, well, you know, what do we actually want the book to look like? And we had to think more about the cross-section of musicians that we were choosing, because we wanted it to reflect a whole bunch of different genres and eras, and so that our musicians in their chapters would tell us about the Fremantle's musical story over time.
So in the end, you finished up with about 29 people who are featured here. So how did you come to settle that way?
Well, it's actually 31, I think, in total.
31, I can't count.
No, it's not that. There's 29 chapters, but a couple of chapters have got two people in them.
Yes.
Like, for instance, the Jam Tarts.
Yes.
I suppose it was an evolving list, and I have to say at this point, Michael, that we never got through the list, and the list got longer and longer, because there is so much musical talent in Fremantle. We could have interviewed a couple of hundred people.
Well, let me ask, because that really is the obvious point. Where do you start and finish in Fremantle? Well, Bill, tell us, where does the book start so far as time is concerned?
In terms of time, it starts with Norm Wrightson and Ray Taylor, who were in the Norm Wrightson Orchestra, and they started as the Norm Wrightson Orchestra in 1949 after Norm's brother, who was a dancer. He was a champion dancer, in fact, was running the dance in Victoria Hall, and he wanted an orchestra, and Norm was playing for somebody else, so he arranged for Norm to get the sack from his other band and to start his own orchestra, and that's how they got going. But Norm was playing before the war. They had the barber's shop, that family, from 1933, and Mrs. Wrightson sent her sons off to the Young Australia League to learn how to play instruments. And that's where they got going, and that's where it begins. And then it picks up again really around the end of the 60s, or, you know, beginning of the 70s, with people like Jim Fisher. Jim's story starts in the book a bit earlier, because it talks about how he got consumed by music when he was having a lonely time in boarding school in England, and the Beatles came through, and it was more than just music. It was the start of real life for Jim.
Well, that brings us to a bigger question we can come back to. Why Fremantle? What is it that Fremantle has about it which sort of engenders the various waves of music that we've seen? But now, you, Bill and Claire, have written all the words in this book, I believe. But, Jeff, you've been roped in along the way to take photographs. How did that happen?
Well, Bill and my friendship goes back many, many years to when we were probably, university in our early 20s. And Bill was working, we had mutual friends. Bill was in a band called Tin Dog, and I actually managed Tin Dog at one stage and used to help set up the gigs and actually organise some gigs at one stage. And I'd set up the lights and run away and do another job and then come back and pack the lights up. So our friendship goes way back. So I got a call from Bill and Claire. We met at a local Fremantle cafe, and Bill and Claire sort of put it to me that they were working on the book. And, you know, because I've worked in publication a little bit and taken photographs, so they sort of tried to get some help from me or some ideas that how could we actually get the book out. I include we in there because I accepted the offer pretty early because it was such a lovely project, and I wasn't doing a lot of work at that time, personal work. So for me, it was a really lovely project to get involved in as I wasn't shooting a lot. So it was a wonderful thing for me to be involved in to get me shooting.
Now, you've taken a huge number of photographs, which is a beautiful part of this book. I think some of the photos probably go back in time, but some are more recent. Over what period did you take the photos?
Oh, gosh, it's almost not quite 2 years, would it be all up?
It would be about 2 years, yeah.
And Claire, in terms of from the conception of the Hilton Bowling Club to the sort of the settling of the final proofs, if you like, what was the duration?
2.5 years, actually. Yeah, but you know, we both had day jobs, so it was something we did at night time, in the evenings, and on weekends. So it did stretch out a bit, and when we managed to get a publishing contract late last year, that gave us a deadline, which was probably a good thing.
Deadlines are the very best things in the world, I think. Now, perhaps Bill and Claire, I can put it to you and you can correct each other, or however. When you commenced and you drew up, whether it was in your mind or on a piece of paper, what the plan for this was going to be, what the shape of it was going to be, what you were going to try and achieve in the book, what was that? And the second follow-up question is, in the final product, do you think you came up with something that was different?
Do you want to go?
No, you go, love.
Okay. The idea was to start to capture some of the stories that explored the relationship between musicians and Fremantle, you know, and as Claire said before, to capture that over time, because the story lies, it's the musicians themselves, but it's also the venues and it's the way that they've influenced each other. So if you read through the chapters in the book, you can hear people talk about the way other people, influenced them as they went. And the influences quite often are not people who are necessarily well known. So if you read John Butler's chapter, for example, you know, it's buskers that made a difference to him, and watching buskers, people who probably not terribly well known, turned him on to playing in tunings, for example. I've digressed, but anyway, and that of course was a turning point in his playing. So those sorts of things are right through the book, and that was really what we were trying to capture, was those things which are there, they're sort of hidden in plain view in terms of how music happens and how it gets transferred and what those accidents are. So just to get an impression of those things, it's not an encyclopedia, and that never set out to be that. So the idea was to capture the feel, if you like. It was quite impressionistic, and for that reason we needed the photographs, because we sort of needed that to come through the imagination and through the senses. The idea behind the book, in a way, was to sort of be the opposite of social media, where stuff flies before your eyes and is gone and it's ephemeral. The idea was to slow that down so you had something in your hands that was considered beautiful and engaged your senses in a range of ways and engaged your imagination. So
I imagine that's kind of what we're trying to do. Yes, well, I'm sure it is considered beautiful and engages in the way you describe. But, Claire, do you think what you produced then subtly developed in any different or unusual directions?
Well, I think it, without trying to achieve this, there are certain themes that come out in the book. And one is probably women in music. We interviewed Greta Little of the Rosemary Beads, and she talks very honestly about how hard it was to be a woman in the industry back then. And then fast forward to Stella Donnelly, who's, you know, today's rising star from Fremantle. It's things have moved on and they've improved a lot, but there's still, you know, women are underrepresented in music, and it shows up in all the statistics. So, you know, that's been an ongoing theme, and things have improved, but maybe not enough. So I think, yeah, the book brings out themes that we didn't really intend. I also think it probably, given its release at this time, where there has been some negative commentary in the media about where Fremantle's going, and, you know, I think it maybe helps in a small way to maybe reset the commentary a bit. It's more feeding hope in what Fremantle is, you know, which is a great creative hub, isn't it? A very isolated, fantastic creative hub.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, one of the strange things for me very often when you go to a gig, take Hidden Treasures, which has been on again this year, you can turn up, hear some great acts playing, and it's almost like a private party, because you don't have thousands of people there, but you have these sort of iconic little venues and some great musicians, and you really feel as if living in Fremantle, being in Fremantle matters. But Bill, what about the venues, both historically and today? There's a lot of chatter that you hear from time to time about there being insufficient venues for people to perform in. What's your take on that, both historically and now?
Well, there's certainly a lot less live venues, but that trend towards those closing down or changing their focus started a long time ago. You know, so that's not a new thing. In fact, people have had whole careers, you know, in the era since that, I suppose you'd say, post-war boom, probably peaked in the 80s, really. But I think one of the things that was behind the book and about Fremantle is that while things have shut down in other places, whether it's boom or bust, people have hung on in Fremantle. That goes for some of those great venues which have nurtured music quite consciously over many years, from, you know, the Stone Crow, Mojo's, Clancy's, the Norfolk, and whatever name the basement has at this particular time.
Aardvark.
Yeah, or, you know...
What is it at the moment?
It's gone from Oddfellows to the Aardvark, and apparently the Oddfellows will phoenix itself out and arise again somewhere else.
Yeah, okay.
Watch this space.
I thought it still was Oddfellows, but there you go.
It changes fast.
So the venue, you know, the fly-by-night club, you know, which is now... Yeah, yes. That's right, and that's you know, that's a story in itself, and they're probably hanging on by their fingernails. That need will remain though, and it will emerge somewhere else. The Gaslight, which was the offshoot of the Fly By Night, was terrifically important because it's the transition between people nervously getting up at an open mic and playing, and then actually earning their first quid. Alongside, they might be playing on the bill with someone who's actually really good and is touring from overseas or something like that. So, you know, Steve Tallis is probably should get a lot of credit for doing that. The venues have been handed from one generation to another and then back again in some cases.
The Victoria Hall is a great example of that. And when we think the Victoria Hall is where that's Ray used to play,
yeah,
and through to its latest, well, unfortunately, the Fly has not there anymore. So that's a great example of one venue over time. And it's not Mojo's, it's not the Crow,
no.
It's not Clancy's.
No. So but it's had a role.
In terms
of this book, it has a role at the very beginning of the book, and it's had another role at the end of the book.
Yeah. Now let me ask, I think related to that, but... where do these artists come from? Have they somehow been generated out of the fabric of Fremantle? Is there something here which has caused that to happen? You're a bit more of an outsider here, in a sense, Claire. You've studied it here. What do you think the answer to this question is?
Well, I actually love Fremantle, so I don't think I can be objective, Michael. But, I mean, in the book, I suppose we did loosely think it'd be really interesting to try and drill down into why Fremantle has so many musicians, why it's such a magnet for musicians. And we didn't really come to a concrete conclusion, but there's various theories from the musicians throughout the book. And so for John Reid, for example, from Sensitive New Age Cowpersons, when he talks about coming to Fremantle in the, I think it was the 70s, he said it was a free and easy place. And
cheap rent.
The rent was cheap, the cars were cheap, the beer was cheap, John says. Mm. And, you know, for Jim Fisher, he was escaping his class, you know, he said. And Abby May, you know, she says it's a haven, it's close to utopia for me. And I think Cav Temperley said in the book he thought it was something to do with the river meeting the sea. You know, so there's lots of different theories. I think even although the rent's not as cheap anymore, there's a bit of a critical mass, I suppose, of musicians now. So the younger ones are here because it's a supportive environment for artists and creative people. And, you know, we've got the city of Fremantle to thank for that as well, because they put on so much, you know, they do so much for the creative community.
Well, that's the next question that really develops out of that. You have a sense, tell me if it's the case, that all of these musicians, young and old, from the 20s to the 90s here, all have a sense of each other, or at least of many of the others. And we say the community is supportive of all sorts of endeavours, particularly in relation to creative ones. What's the infrastructure, if you like, which enables it to remain creative? We've mentioned the city of Fremantle, they're keen to support creative industries, musicians. Is there any danger, do you think, Bill, that it can be diminished over time?
Well, who knows what's in the future, really. I think a lot of it's pretty self-sustaining, and it comes from a genuine creative impulse that's actually in people. I think the city's been good, actually, over the years. I think it has recognised that its creative arts and pursuits are a big part of what the city is. As I said, you know, I've been coming into Fremantle since I started riding my bike in here from Hilton Park in the late 70s, and I've been away for some years, but I've probably spent more than 40 years of my life living within a mile or two of where I am now. And this town sort of goes through boom and bust, and, you know, sometimes there's a bit more money around than others. But this has been a gradual accretion in my time that I've seen of what I think's a kind of cultural depth. There's a value that's placed. It's not particularly materialistic place in that sense, you know. People, money comes along and everybody's happy to have a quid. But when it blows away and there's a few empty shops, the town doesn't go away. And these other parts of what make a community and make a town start to emerge, and you see them. And the beauty that's available to everybody in terms of just reflecting on what's happening in their lives or in the time or in the rest, or, you know, it's all there and it seems to be absorbed and worked. So is it going to go away? Is it going to dissolve? I can't see necessarily why. I can't see why it would. Mm. You know, there's been nothing in it in a material sense for most of these musicians for most of their life, but they've pursued their craft. And I think that was, you know, going back to the beginning, that was one of the inspirations for the book, was the fact that, you know, what people... So say there's a lot of ephemeral stuff in people's lives now. There's a deluge of information, well, of... I guess it's information in a very crude sense. But people just seem to be working. You know, I said, I think somewhere in the write, that the music's handmade. It's still got that craft, that sort of thing about it. I don't know what I'm saying now.
You're doing good. You're doing good.
Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the bowlers have been really important in that of maintaining where we are now. Yes, we have. You look down High Street now and you go to Hidden Treasures, like, you know, a lot of us did last Thursday. You've got the Buffalo Club, you've got the Navy Club, you've got, you know, the Wires just around the corner. Oh, it's on, but they're all High Street. But then you look further down, some of us remember the P&O, you know, is gone. A lot of the older pubs have been absorbed by Notre Dame. So a lot of things have disappeared. But there are still places which are holding true. And the North Fremantle Bowling Club, the East Freo Bowling Club, the Hilton Bowling Club have taken up, in a lot of ways, that slack, which has been really... And you get that feeling of camaraderie, where you do get the younger musicians coming through with their first gigs, playing the first slot, second slot of the night, and then the more mature, experienced acts coming on. And there's always that sharing. I think it's Helen Townsend talks about that, you know, her career has come on quite late in her life. But you know, having the performance and going back to someone's house and sitting around a campfire and playing until the early hours. Dave Hyams says the same thing about a lot of the stuff happened after hours. You know, you play through to 5 in the morning. And so there's always been that sense of camaraderie. And even with Stella Donnelly and the younger people in it is that camaraderie of playing with other players, learning from them, and is that lovely interaction.
Now, let me ask another question that I think's related to that as well, and it's this: is there a Fremantle sound? Is there any segueing from one era to the next? Is there something which, if you study it in a musicological scientific sense, that makes whatever has happened over the period you are talking about, post-war, particularly 60s on till now, which makes Fremantle and the development of what we're talking about look quite different from, for example, what might have happened in any other part of Australia. Do you have a view about that, Bill?
Yeah, I would say this. I think we're now in an era where the transference of musical ideas between communities is a torrent of information. So is there a Fremantle sound? I don't think you could say there is. I think somebody asked Bob Gordon that too, and I think that's what he said. But there is a sort of a scene. I think locally, if you trace, and it's actually in the book, you trace the stories of people, you can trace the influences of them from watching other people playing live. And that's certainly there, and that's in the community. The degree to which that's reflected in a sound that you could pick out in a blind tasting from what you might get, say, from other places, I don't think you necessarily would. I think there is there was an interest in what we these days call roots music, which is followed right the way through, and maybe that was alive here when it wasn't of much interest in other places.
Well, that's right. I mean, Wayne Green said in his interview that he couldn't get a gig in Fremantle with his rock band, his heavy rock band, back in the...
Early
80s. Probably.
Early 80s. You need to be rich and blues or something.
At that time, yes. And he said Brewer that...
It's hard to get a gig in... Did Dave Brewer say the same about getting a gig in Frio?
I don't recall that, but I remember that Wayne Green, in his interview... describes the Fremantle Bridge as crossing the Mexican border. Of course, he now lives down here not finding it so hard to get a gig in Fremantle, so it's much more diverse now.
Now, when it comes to this book, if you were trying to get people to wander into... I always get the name of the bookshop wrong. Is it first edition or new edition on High Street? New edition. I always say first edition. New edition. And you've got a range of people there, and they're my 13-year-old granddaughter, or it's my 89-year-old mother, or it's people right in between. Claire, what would you say to my granddaughter, Emily, as to why she should pick this book up and read it?
Well, that's a difficult one, Michael.
what will she learn from it?
Well, I think she'll learn about the musical story of Fremantle over time. And there's some younger musicians there who, if she's into music, she might find inspiring. Mm. For instance, Stella Donnelly's story.
Yes.
And Stella's saying since she's been sort of playing and before that, but now she's seeing that when people come to watch her play, women, young women now realise that they, you know, that they can get up and play too, and they're, you know, going and getting guitars and playing them. So she's got a very inspiring story, I think, that would appeal to a girl in her teens for sure. But also I think it's probably, this is an important sort of cultural record of Fremantle. So there's a lot of good historical sort of information in there. Can you add anything, love?
What about my elderly mother, Mill?
Well, I'd say whether you're 13 or 89, this is a book full of stories about people's dreams and people who have held on to their dreams, because whether, in the case of Helen Townsend, she didn't really get anywhere with her music till she was 40, she was thinking about doing it from her teens. So that's kind of one of the things that I really enjoyed about it, talking to all these people, was the fact that they are people who, whether they got anywhere in the profession, you know, in a way, in the sort of way we often talk about it, they did. They dreamed about doing this. They put some work into it, and most of them are still doing it, you know, whatever the hell age they are. So whether you're 13 or 89, there's something in that to read about that.
Now, tell me, what parts of either researching or writing this book were you surprised about in terms of how hard or how interesting, or in terms of the satisfaction that you got out of it? And Jeff, I want to ask you the same thing about the photographs and the circumstances in which they occurred. Claire, were there points in this where you were sort of blown away by what you were doing?
Not really, but I think we constantly, and as we did more interviews, we realised that we had to really try and focus on people's Fremantle stories, because otherwise it would become like an encyclopedia. And really, there's a lot of musicians in this book who, if you Google them, you'll find a whole lot of information out there about them, and we didn't want to repeat that. So I think that was one of the biggest challenges, was actually going in and interviewing people like Lucky Oceans and keeping it to his Fremantle story, really, you know, keeping the focus narrow but rich, if you know what I mean, rather than it becoming like this huge big thing. So I thought that was quite challenging, but we got better at that, I think, as we went along. We didn't do very long rambling interviews. We sort of really tried to sort of nail it down. Apart from that, I don't really think there was anything else.
That's the title, Frio Groove. Yes. Everything brings you back to Fremantle.
It does, yeah. We've tried to focus on that.
Bill, in a related way, you've mentioned some of the eras, but what was the... If there is a high point in the Frio Groove, on the face of it, according to some historical record or another, when was it, or is it right now?
Look, I think it's now just as much as ever. If you talk to anybody in along the story, you know, that older players might reflect on, you know, when things were at their most exciting for them. But that's a personal, you know, point on the landscape. It seems to me that that it's really healthy. And it's
I suppose a difference for some people would be that there's not, you know, there was a period where there were gigs to be had in all the pubs, you know,
true,
five nights of the week. That's not the case now.
Yeah.
So,
but also some of those moments for them weren't the gigs. It was the wandering, for John Butler, wandering the streets early in the morning, walking down High Street towards the roundhouse. It was Kevin Parker with his headsets on, walking around the power station in South Frio. It's interesting what were moments for the musicians, and they didn't always gravitate to the best gig. obviously that came through in some of the stories. It was, what was it about Fremantle that they loved, brought them back? You know, it wasn't necessarily the big moments. It was more the moments of contemplation.
Yeah, I find that a very hard question to answer. I don't feel like I've got any particular vantage point on it, because I think the book is a bit of a window into that. But it's, God.
I imagine very often it's going to, if there is an answer to it, it's going to be someone's personal reflections. If people had a very hectic decade in the 80s in Fremantle, that's what they're primarily going to remember, I suppose. And then the musical tastes change. But what seems to have come out of your observations earlier is the Fremantle, perhaps like a lot of the Perth music scene, is some sort of polyglot. It's some sort of pluralistic society. You can play what you want to play, and you've got the freedom to do it. And you don't all have to be Tame Impala. You don't all have to be Blues and Roots. You don't all have to be country or whatever it is. That does seem to be something that's reflected by looking through here. Some of the people have been in major national and international acts, but they have this Fremantle route to their to their lives. Is that what comes through this?
Yeah, I think as Jeff said, even Kevin Parker from Tame Impala, he always says that you can be anywhere and make music. So location isn't always relevant to your music. But for him, with his latest album, he was producing it down in his little studio on South Terrace there, where he's converted a little weatherboard into a fantastic studio. And there was just something not kind of working with it, and he put on his headset and wandered down to the power station at South Fremantle and came back with a whole lot of new thoughts about how he was going to craft the album. So what was your question again, Michael?
Well, it's
nailed it, Claire.
Well, I think the answer is there, that people find inspiration where they're living. Well, imagine how much more Kev would have been inspired if they'd still had the smokestacks on the power station. It's a great crime that they ever took them off. Hopefully they'll put them back.
There was a story of Norm Wrightson's about a gig at the Victoria Hall, where they're playing on stage, and his brother, they're both scrawny little guys, they could almost be jockeys, and his brother's doing the door, and a fight breaks out, okay, at the Victoria Hall. Norm puts down his sax, climbs off the stage, goes up to the door to help his brother. They both end up jumping on the backs of these guys to try and quell the fight. Norm's backed into a corner, a table breaks. They finally get the guys out of the venue. Norm goes back on stage, picks up the sax, starts playing again. But then there's a trickle down the back of his leg. And a shard of glass from the broken table has gone into one of his buttock. And there's blood all over the place. So then his wife has to post-gig, fix him up, and get him on the road. So that whole, that was a beautiful, the rock and roll aspect of a jazz band in, when Norm was playing, to, I suppose, Wayne Green's tales of playing, in venues where he was pretty scared, was interesting. And those little stories, those little tidbits were fantastic for me. And as the photographer, I was able to have the lovely interviews that had been conducted to work with, to then inspire me to try and work out and discuss with the musician where we could shoot. Yeah.
So the question I was coming to you on was, amongst the photographs you've taken, all of which are wonderful, are there some that stand out?
I'd like to say also Matt Clifton also took images for the book. It wasn't only me. I took predominantly the portraits. Matt took the Lucky portrait, Lucky Oceans, and also did some of the live work, so we did work together. It was interesting. What was challenging for me is I didn't want to make stereotypical images of people, in certain locations. So I tried to be quite subtle, linking those. So if people know Fremantle, then they might be able to pick the location where they are. Some are more obvious than others. But really it was about the person and their face. And there will be you know, Dave Brewer suggested his location, where we shot near the port, near the harbour, and that beautiful Port Authority building, which is architecturally one of my favourite buildings in Fremantle. It's just gorgeous. And Dave said, let's shoot there. And I said, yep, let's go. So he rocked up with his son. He brought down his Telecaster. And we got some shots down there, which was just gorgeous to shoot. You know, it's a beautiful location. So quite often it was a reflection with the musician themselves, and then we worked through it over a coffee, and that slowed the process down, which is wonderful. To have that option that you just don't have to run in there, snap a shot and run away. You can work through it, find a time, which was difficult with musicians because you can't say, oh, the sun's really good, it's 5:30 in the morning, let's go, because they go, no, I had a gig last night, mate, there's no way I'm going to get up that early. So we usually had to work maybe in the afternoons. But yeah, most of them are taken on location. Favourite shots, I really like the Greta Little shot with her bass at Mojo's. We did talk about what your young granddaughter might get out of the book, and I think that progression of women in music is really strong, whether it's Greta, Lee Sappho, Helen Townsend, through to Abby, and then Abby, and then leading into also into Stella. And that strength of women in music, I think, is very pertinent to this moment, and working with all those were great, yeah.
Well, I think we're sort of drawing to an end with this interview, which takes in one direction or another. I can tell the listeners, if they haven't already discovered this by looking at the fabulous book Frio Groove themselves, that at first glance it said it would look nice on a coffee table, but the reason it will look nice on a coffee table is you will want to pick it up and read it. And if you're a Perth person, but particularly a Fremantle person, and you look through, first of all, Bill Lurie's Ford, and then you look at the 1 to 29 artists who are mentioned, who in fact in the discussion, as Claire points out, totals 31, you're going to see some great contemporary names, people who've made it big here, people you'll immediately say, I'm not sure who they are. But it's all about Fremantle, people's location in Fremantle and the creative industries that exist in Fremantle. The photographs are fabulous. Some of them take you back in time. Some of them take you to the Fremantle that we all know and love now. So it's the sort of book, if you're a student, I think you are going to learn a lot. I can't wait to read it in more depth. I think you can pick up any of the chapters, if we call them that, the stories one by one, and read them. Read them before you go to sleep. The only trouble is I'll probably keep you awake because you want to read the next one. But for the three of you, but particularly for Claire and Bill, what comes after this? Has this excited you into some other new project? The two of you play music together as well, don't you? But what about in these writing terms? What have you got in mind?
Well, we haven't decided yet, but recently I saw the book described on Instagram as a comprehensive overview of Fremantle's musical culture, and I thought, no, it's definitely not a comprehensive overview. And I explained to the author of the Instagram post that that actually there's so many more musicians we could have interviewed. So I actually think there's another volume to be done.
Oh, good. Do I hear an echo, Bill?
There's plenty more that could be written about this. You know, from other perspectives. You know, I think the from the point of view of the guys in the back line, the drums and the bass players are a bit underrepresented here.
Yes. The rhythm section.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, there's certainly other stories that can be told. Yeah, and I'm keen to do a bit more writing. This is my first book, and I don't want it to be my last, that's for sure.
Well, congratulations to the three of you for the words, the photos, for recording this highly significant part of Fremantle's post-Second War history. I was going to say post-war, but there are so many damn wars on in the world, you have to be careful which one you might be taken to be referring to. But we're talking about a 70-year history of what's been going on with Fremantle. So in many ways you can draw a social and political and some sort of economic history out of this as you read it, I suppose. So congratulations to the three of you, the four of you. because Matt's not here at the moment, to do WA Publishing for a beautifully made and edited book. And it's out on sale now. You simply need to Google Frio Groove and you'll find plenty of places to buy it. But if you get along to the launch this Thursday night at the Navy Club, no doubt you'll be able to obtain at good prices signed copies of it. Anyway, well done, you guys, and we'll look forward to hearing about the next volume.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.